Why would you not want to anger a crow?
Because they have good memories. And it's one thing to have a momentary burst of anger and yell at a crow or threaten a crow, but you might have to suffer for years because crows remember who people are, and they will scold them for years, as we know from research.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jim Robbins about the wonder of birds, what they tell us about ourselves, the world, and a better future. His detailed nonfiction, exploring everything from the origin of flight to the philosophy of bird watching. Do you have a favorite collective noun for birds?
Probably a murmuration, which isn't a species, but it's a particular kind of gathering of birds. When thousands, many thousands of birds come together, and somehow there's some sort of aerial ballet they do where they are able to key off each other and do these great swoops and dives. One poet described them as a drunken fingerprint rolling across the sky. And they do it without colliding, without bumping into each other, and no one knows. It's a great mystery, and I think that's probably my favorite collective noun for birds.
I'm wondering if you can read the part about murmurations.
I will. On a nickel-gray fall day, while I was with Mark Reynolds, the biologist with the Nature Conservancy, reporting on pop-up wetlands, I was witness to my first Dance of the Dunlins. As I stood watching, the Dunlin suddenly left the still mirrored surface of a pond and went airborne, erupting as one into a great undulating cloud. Like an aerial marching band, they first created a teardrop shape, then suddenly turned and shifted in unison to create a flat block shape, and then rolled over into a circle. They changed color, too, first flashing gray feathers in unison, then brown, and then white. I stood there in open-mouthed silence, mesmerized by one of the most wondrous of nature's wild bird mysteries. Biologists believe these murmurations, as they are called, must be in some way vital to bird survival. Why else would birds spend so much energy forming them? The most common theory is that such swarming is a defense against predators, a constantly shifting set of group eyes watching for danger, as well as a flock making a much bigger and stronger target than single birds. The constant twisting and turning may also be a defense mechanism that confuses those who seek to eat the birds. Or it could be that these formations are some sort of complex signaling, a way to show other birds where to roost or feed. It might be a way for leaders to assess the condition of the flock, if indeed there are leaders. One researcher who specializes in the study of animal swarms believes that the Dance of the Dunlins and other flocks may both be a product of, as well as generate, what is called metacognition, a collective mind that is much bigger and smarter than the sum of its parts.
The title of your book is The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About Ourselves, the World, and a Better Future. One of the things that your book does is connect bird attributes and behaviors to human attributes and behaviors. And in terms of murmurations, you use the term meta-wisdom. Is there anything you can say about how we might use the example of swarm theory to better understand humans?
Well, some of the things that researchers are looking at in terms of meta-wisdom is when people leave a soccer stadium very quickly, at the end of a match, or if there's some sort of emergency somewhere and people have to flee a crowded theater, is how do people acknowledge the movement of other people and create a crowd, essentially. And so they're studying to try and divine that. Then there are people designing robots that would swim underwater, drones that fly through the sky that behave in flock-like behaviors. And that is that they're kind of keying off other members of the flock. And these are in development now, by the way. And they are self-organizing, so that if something happens to one of the robots, say underwater, or searching for a wrecked submarine or something, if it were to lose power and disappear, then the other ones would all adjust, and they would kind of have their own intelligence and recreate the flock or the school on their own. That's one way. But I think perhaps the most interesting way this research at MIT is trying to look for answers to climate change. And they've brought thousands of academics together online to create a kind of metacognition, all these people working together to create wisdom that's bigger than each of the individual components. I think that's probably the most interesting thing I've heard about this idea of meta-wisdom.
In thinking about soccer stadiums, it took me to England. There's another example from the streets of London in your book, where cab drivers in London have to pass a pretty brutal examination to acquire the knowledge, which Uber has, I think, now made irrelevant. What's the bird example of the knowledge?
The bird example of the knowledge would be Clark's Nutcracker, which are here in Montana. They live in the high country near white bark pine trees, and they cache thousands, tens of thousands of nuts all over the hillside or the mountainside. And remember, I think two-thirds of those nuts, where they're stashed, where they put them, how deep, and they recover them. And it's just like a cab driver has to learn the streets of London to make a living. These birds have to know where they keep all of these nuts in order to survive. And so it's really an evolutionary driver of these birds, this memory. And so Clark's Nutcrackers have been a really important area of study for researchers to understand more about memory and how it evolves.
What does fruitcake have to do with bird brains?
Bird brains look like a fruitcake. Human brains look like a layer cake. And our brain is stacked in three layers, and a bird brain is kind of a little bit of chaos, I think, is like a fruitcake. But the take-home message from the chapter about bird brains is really that birds and humans have very similar intellects. And for a long time, people thought birds were dumb. They called them bird brains, of course. And what they realized is that birds solved all the problems we did, but they solved it with a very different kind of brain. But a lot of the microarchitecture of the bird brain is very similar to humans. Auditory system, speech system. You know, it's all very similar to how humans operate in terms of their brain. In fact, many people who study language study bird brains because birds learn to sing very much like humans. They listen to their father sing, and they babble a little bit. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And over time, they learn their own song. And that's very similar to how humans do that. And so it's a very important method of studying human speech.
What else can you say about the purpose of the bird song?
Well, like a lot of things with birds, I think there's a lot that's unknown. But from what we know about birdsong is it does seem to be a mood elevator in humans. A lot of indigenous people use birdsong as an environmental indicator, how moist conditions are, whether there's game out there, whether there's someone approaching the village. Birdsong has a very wide range of uses in the human world. And people who have lovebirds or other singing birds. I just read something online. It's not bird song, but a woman was convicted of murder when the parrot was in her apartment, said, "Don't shoot me," in the voice of the person who was killed.
No way.
Yeah, it was online today, as a matter of fact. So there's lots of role. And I also read an article about parrots who were taught to speak escaping into the wild and teaching wild parrots how to talk.
You give a number of examples in the book about how birds serve humans. Can you share just a couple?
They're called ecosystem services. And birds have not widely been considered to be important in terms of ecosystem services. But there's been a lot of research done in the last 10 or 15 years. And it turns out there's a lot more going on there than we thought. And one of the big ones is bird guano, bird poop. You know, I was in New York a couple months ago, and I was walking down the street, and this pigeon pooped right on top of my coffee cup. And this is right after the book came out. And I thought, wow, what's going on here? Is this some sort of cosmic coincidence or an insult or something? Anyway, bird poop, it turns out, is an important part of the natural world because birds eat seeds. They don't digest them fully. And then they deposit those seeds all around the world in this potent package of fertilizer. And so they spread, they're called mobile resource linkers. They connect disparate parts of the natural world. And very important studies have shown that if seeds fall to the ground, that seed predators come and pretty much eat all of them. But if there are birds around, they'll come in, they'll eat some of the seeds, but then they'll fly off and drop them somewhere. And so it helps regenerate different species of trees and flowers and so on in the natural world. That's one way, one important way that birds serve humans.
And what is bird's nest soup?
Well, I've never had it, but bird's nest soup is, there are swifts in Asia, and they make these white nests from their saliva. And they're harvested by people who gather nests together and clean them. And then in China, it's very much considered a delicacy. In fact, it's one of the most expensive foods out there. It's $100 for a bowl of soup. And people then boil it and make it into a gelatinous kind of soup. And it's considered to have a number of different health benefits.
And going back to the ways in which humans utilize birds, I'm wondering if you can read a little bit about hunting.
Yes. I will say this first. When I wrote this book, I hunted birds. And I've hunted birds for a long time. And as I wrote this book, I came to a place now where I don't know if I'll hunt birds again. Yeah. Because they are so smart, and they have emotions, they have intellect. I mean, I learned this in the course of this book. I don't eat chickens at Costco anymore. There's a chapter about that in there. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I'll hunt birds again. And once you learn all these things, it's kind of like, it's kind of like a revelation about birds. And I think there's a lot more going on here than I certainly realized. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I think it's a very personal choice. Sure. Obviously, I have hunted birds. But I do think that we should have all the information about these things when we make our decision. That's what I try to provide here. All right, so I will read this nonetheless. I hunt on the vast swells of remote and sparsely populated prairie that stretch along Montana's border with Alberta. The region is called the High Line after the single train track that was built through here in the late 1800s. It's a remote and largely forgotten place dotted with small ranching and farming towns in decline, with empty storefronts and abandoned homesteads. Often I start where the silhouette of the Bear's Paw Mountains sits like an illusion in the distance, a short drive from the tiny town of Chinook, Montana. Walking across the broad sweep of grassy prairie of northern Montana day after day is an immersion into a starkly beautiful landscape. On the days I hunt, I become a predator, and the experience touches some deep and ancient part of my psyche, a calm, though vigilant, deeply felt energy, providing me with the stamina to hike mile after mile along creeks and down one-lane dirt roads, all but oblivious to distances covered or the hours passed, consumed only with thoughts about in which patch of chokecherry, cattails, or thick grass the birds might be hiding. There is a transcendent aesthetic to the entire bird hunting experience. When I hunt, I pay attention to my world very differently than in my usual life. I use my senses in ways I don't normally use them, listening for a rustle in the thick, brambly creek bottom, noting the direction of the wind, watching for the flash of brilliant colors as a cock runs into a grain field far ahead, remaining alert to rattlesnakes and smelling damp grass as the frost melts late on October mornings. Hunting behind a trained and passionate bird dog is central to the experience. It's exhilarating to wait for a bird to flush as an intensely focused, loudly sniffing canine disappears into a wall of grass as high as his head or a thick curtain of shuddering cattails to ferret out roosters too wise to fly and become a target until they no longer have a choice. The anticipation is primal for both the dog and me.
You've been listening to Jim Robbins read from The Wonder of Birds, what they tell us about ourselves, the world, and a better future. This is The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson. This conversation is available online at mtpr.org. While you're there, why not sign up for our podcast and visit our Facebook page? you went to a very strange place in Los Angeles. Will you describe your feather journey there?
Yes, it's a business called Mother Pluckers. Be careful how I say that. And a couple there who run it have been doing it for a long time. Willie is the name of the man who owns it, and he made feathered earrings back in the 70s when he was a hippie, and he said it just evolved into making costumes for Hollywood. They make costumes for strippers. They make costumes for showgirls in Las Vegas. They make costumes for movies. They had just made a big chicken costume for someone on a fast food commercial. So they are expert in feathers, and they say there is nothing like a feather. You cannot get the same drape, the same look, the same sensuousness from any other material that you can get from a feather. And feathers, for that reason, are a big business still in the costume industry, and even more so now that we have things like Burning Man and Lightning in a Bottle and other festivals where people are discovering the beauty of feathers and wearing them. And of course, this is something that Native Americans and many other indigenous tribes have known for a long time, that feathers are beautiful and important because birds fly and they're a connection to the heavens. So I think there's a lot to feathers, more perhaps than we think.
And you got to try on a pair of wings while there. Were you tempted to bring them home?
Angel wings, yes, and they fit quite well. Red ones, kind of ruby red angel wings. And I thought, wow, they fit pretty good, too. The white ones didn't fit so good. They were a little small, but the red ones fit perfectly. And it was like Cinderella. I thought, wow, there's something going on here. These are not just the right fit. There's a message here with these angel wings. And I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that is.
The shopkeep, Willie, one of the things you quote him as saying is, humans have always been attracted to birds. They control the sky. What else did you learn about humans' symbolism throughout the process of writing this book?
You know, I love natural history. I've written a lot of natural history in my life, but I feel like I've read a lot of books about birds and about natural history, so I wanted to bring something very different to this book. I want to have natural history in it, but I want to have more about why birds appeal to us, what the attraction is, what's the impact, and birds, of course, are transcendent. And I really try to get at that in this book. Why do we love birds so much? And there's several chapters that go into the psychology of birds in different ways. And I think it is because they're transcendent. They lift us. And you can say that, and you can understand that and believe that. But let's go further. Let's dig a little deeper, or let's dig a lot deeper, and find out exactly what's behind that. Unpack it, and see if we can enhance it.
The bar-headed geese going over Mount Everest. What's their story?
One of the interesting things about birds I didn't know about until I began this is they have very extreme physiology, some of them. And they're used by scientists to understand our own physiology. Again, a way to interpret birds to tell us something about them, but also to tell us something about ourselves. And the bar-headed goose flies higher than any other bird by a factor of 4 or 5. People have seen it flying above Mount Everest, which is 29,000 feet, so 5 miles up. And how did it do this? How did it evolve this? Well, it evolved a whole system to deal with this oxygen level, which is 20% of what it is on the ground. Yet there they are. In a day, they cross the Himalayas. And they have lungs that can breathe air twice. They have more capillaries in their lungs. They have wings and more loft than other birds, similar birds. They have all of these adaptations that have enabled them to do things that no other bird can do, and certainly humans can't do. So I looked at this and what it tells us about human health, and it turns out that they think some of these things that bar-headed geese can do might help humans be able to heal from certain lung conditions and things like that. They think that these bar-headed geese have been flying this route for millions of years before the Himalayas were formed, and that they, over 70 million years, adapted these physiologies as the mountains rose, and they slowly had to fly higher and higher from India to Tibet, and that over a very long period of time, they could evolve all of these adaptations to be able to make this incredible flight.
You catalog a fact that half of the first-year students in biology at the University of Oxford can't name 5 British birds and 20% can't name one. What's the significance of being able to identify and name birds?
Well, there's certainly an importance in knowing the natural world around you and what's there. And, I mean, it sustains us. The natural world sustains us, and we should know about it. So there's that level of what we should be understanding about the world that we live in. But what's bigger is we've lost our connection to nature. As much as we, as important as it is to us, we really don't pay a lot of attention to it. At least a lot of us don't. And I think that's one of the things I hope to encourage with this book is to have people read this and say, wow, there are so many things about birds. I guess the take-home message from this book is how little we really know about the world and how fascinating it is. And it would place us in great peril if we destroy it, and we are destroying it. So I hope to encourage some wonder, hence the name Wonder of Birds, about birds. I mean, you would think, well, people have been researching birds for a long time. We probably know a lot about their behaviors and so on. But what this book is a deep dive into how little we really know about birds. And it's humbling to realize how little we know. And I actually, my tree book, which was called The Man Who Planted Trees, was a similar type take on the world. We think we understand the trees. We think we understand birds. But both of those are looking at how little we really know about the world. And that should really hit home with us. And we should make an effort to understand the world, because there's things going on with birds and trees and other natural phenomena that are really important, life-sustaining. And yet our understanding is really, really poor.
If you could give one recommendation to listeners about how to aid in the conservation of birds, what would it be?
Inform yourself. That is the biggest one, is to read about these things, to talk to people who are working on the front lines of conservation, understand where the most important habitat is, how that habitat can be conserved. Get off of Facebook, go out into the natural world, reconnect with nature. I think that's the most important thing of all. I mean, a lot of the answer to this question that you asked me is not out there in the world protecting habitat. That's important, but it's in our nervous system. It's being comfortable in the world. It's knowing something about the natural world. It's spending time outdoors. I mean, I really think that we've neglected that part of our being, the internal part. I mean, I talk in a couple of places in the book about perception. And there are people who have gone on their whole life and not thought about birds. And then one day they saw a bird and they saw it. I don't mean they just saw it visually. They saw it and perceived it. And that epiphany, that coming to see a bird for more than just a thing out there flying around, but for the miracle or the wonder that it really is, that's the battle. And people can do that. That can be taught. That can be experienced, but people have to go out in nature. They have to take their kids out. They have to really immerse themselves. And after a few days of that, you'll start to notice a change, not only in your understanding, your intellectual understanding, but your feeling of being in the natural world.
And birding or bird watching seems to have taken off culturally. And I'm wondering if you can just share the little snippet that you include in the book about the psychology of what it means to be a bird watcher.
Okay, this is kind of a heavy topic, but I think it's important. And I was shocked when I heard this, but I think intuitively it made a lot of sense to me. I interviewed an ornithologist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in New York, which is the nation, if not the world's, premier institute for the study of birds. And she wrote a paper, although she studies bluebirds and bird families and things like that, she wrote a paper about climate change and why people don't, why people deny climate change. And what she said was, she quoted some work from Ernest Becker, who's a writer who wrote a book called The Denial of Death. He's a cultural anthropologist that won the Pulitzer Prize in 72. And his theory at the time was that we carry this hidden fear of death all of our lives, and it affects us. It affects our nervous system, but we don't know it's there. But it's nonetheless, it governs our behavior. And we all have it, everyone. It's inherent in the species. And there's been a lot of research since then to back that up in a field called terror management theory. And what she says about climate change in her paper, it's called The People Paradox, you can find it online, is that people deny climate change because it's a way of denying this fear of mortality that we all carry with us. And she said birds are run counter to that, though, that birds are a relief from this terror, this anxiety, this existential angst, that they that there's something we do called striving for immortality as humans. In response to this subconscious fear we carry, we look for things that will give us symbolic immortality. It might be religion. It might be patriotism. And it is birds. I think there's no question about that. I think part of the reason birding is such an addiction is that it's a transcendent relief from earthly concerns, from fear, and it's a way of projecting our need for immortality onto something that provides it, and I think birds do that very well.
If you could be reborn as a bird, which bird would you like to be?
Well, that's not really a very hard question. Vahi Alvedarian has a company called Falcon Force, and he takes his falcons out. He travels along the coast of California for farmers. He also works for SeaWorld in San Diego. They have problems with seagulls that come to the roller coaster ride, and they sit on the rails. And when the roller coaster comes down one of these runs, the birds fly up, and they hit people in the face because the roller coaster is going 80 miles an hour. And when a bird flies up and it hits someone in the face, it can be almost deadly. So he flies his falcons there. And you can go online and look at Falcon Force and look at all of the different, he has under the heading Our Staff, he's got all these different falcons that are pictures of which are on the page. But the most beautiful bird I've ever seen, and he has one of them, is called an Aplomato falcon. Aplomato refers to the color, kind of a lead color. But I think this has changed over time, but I think that I would like to come back as an Aplomato falcon.
Jim Robbins lives in Helena, Montana. In addition to books, he's also a freelance writer and has carried out assignments in Europe, Mongolia, Peru, Chile, Mexico, and across North America. Look for more information about him and his book at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.